This is Audible.
Welcome. You are about to embark on a unique learning adventure from the Great Courses. Our courses are crafted to be entertaining journeys, both comprehensive and fascinating. They're designed to expand horizons, deepen understanding, and foster epiphanies in a broad array of subjects and university-level disciplines. The lecturers are university professors and subject matter experts carefully selected by the Great Courses and its customers for their intellectual distinction and exceptional abilities to teach. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalogs or visit our website at thegreatcourses.com and imagine how much you can learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the company of some of the greatest minds in the world. These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. These lectures are titled, Building a Better Vocabulary. Your lecturer is Professor Kevin Flanagan. Professor Flanagan is a professor of education in the literacy department at Westchester University of Pennsylvania. He holds an M.E.D. and a Ph.D. in reading education from the University of Virginia. Professor Flanagan teaches graduate and undergraduate literacy education courses and supervises graduate-level teachers as they work with students in kindergarten through 12th grade who struggle with literacy skills. In 2011, he was nominated for the U.S. Professors of the Year Award. Professor Flanagan is the co-author of three books and has authored or co-authored articles in a number of professional journals, including The Reading Teacher, The Journal of Adolescent and Adult Literacy, and The Journal of Literacy Research. Lecture 1. Five Principles for Learning Vocabulary.
Ever since I was a kid, I've been moved, awed, and at times even gobsmacked by the power and magic of words. And I can even remember the exact moment that I was hooked. It was my dad who did it to me. Now, my siblings and I were Army brats, living on post in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. My father, a Special Forces Green Beret, infantry captain at the time, would often come home late, right from the field, still decked out in his camouflage fatigues. In contrast to most other families, it was our dad who read us to sleep. He'd turn off our bedroom lights, flick on his military-issue field flashlight, you know, the kind with a 90-degree bend, with a red lens over the bulb, which lent his face an eerie glow as he began telling his stories. Now, this particular night, we were reading J.R.R. Tolkien's classic fantasy trilogy, The Lord of the Rings. And in a passage describing one of our favorite characters, the wise wizard Gandalf the Grey, he read, "The last thing that Pippin saw as sleep took him was a dark glimpse of the old wizard huddled on the floor, shielding a glowing chip in his gnarled hands between his knees." I can still remember my dad saying, "Gnarled. The perfect word. It even sounds like what it means. Listen again." And as he so often did, he read the sentence again, savoring the word gnarled this time. "What's gnarled mean?" we asked. We were hooked. Twisted and knotted. Can't you just picture this ancient sorcerer with knotted, twisted hands like this, lighting his pipe? My dad acted out Gandalf huddled over, lighting an imaginary pipe, using his flashlight as the glowing chip. We went on to discuss other twisted and knotty things, like branches and ropes. And then my dad challenged us. "See how many gnarled things you can find tomorrow, and tell me at dinner." The next day, I had an epiphany. I saw gnarled tree trunks, gnarled branches, even a woman's gnarled features as she screwed up her face at her unruly kids in the grocery store. How did so many gnarled things suddenly pop up overnight? Now, I tell you this story because it demonstrates the power of words to change how we see the world. Of course, gnarled things had always been there, but it took me learning a word to really see those things for myself. A word made all the difference. So when people ask me, why should I spend my time and effort improving my vocabulary? Do words really matter? Well, as my story illustrates, I definitely believe that they do. And not only because learning new words like gnarled can give us joy and even change our very perception of the world. I also know the practical value of developing a rich vocabulary. Indeed, our ability to use vocabulary effectively is one of the primary means by which we communicate and connect with the important people in our lives, our colleagues at work, our family and friends, and even the wider world. Choosing the just right word adds precision and clarity to our speech and our writing. Words are tools we use to inform, advise, persuade, and reason. Words really do matter. But where do we start? I mean, there are so many words to learn and so little time. Well, what we really need is a structured approach, a framework that we can use for a lifetime of vocabulary learning. And that's exactly what I'm going to give you today. I'm going to identify 5 core principles for building and using a rich vocabulary. And if you honor these principles and the strategies that arise from them, you'll have an efficient method for harnessing the power of the English language. Now, before I enumerate these principles, however, let's explore an important general concept in vocabulary learning, the dimmer switch phenomenon. Okay, now, learning words is not an all-or-nothing affair, as though one moment we've never heard a word before and then, bang, immediately after looking it up in the dictionary, we become an expert user of that word. That would be like flipping a light switch from off to on. A better metaphor that vocabulary researchers Camille Blackowitz and Peter Fisher use is the dimmer switch. Now, my own family has a dimmer switch in our dining room, and we can gradually increase the amount of light that we want. This is how vocabulary learning works, gradually and incrementally. First, we learn the dictionary definition of a word. Then gradually we become more comfortable with how that word is used in various contexts as we try it out ourselves. So to give you a more concrete sense of this dimmer switch phenomenon, I'm going to say 3 vocabulary words out loud in a few moments, and I'm going to ask you to rate your knowledge of each word on a vocabulary knowledge scale. Now, this scale is from the work of educational researchers Edgar Dale and Joseph O'Rourke, who proposed 4 levels of word knowledge. So on the scale, a rating of 1 means I do not know the word and I have never seen it before. A rating of 2 means I've heard the word before, but I'm not sure what it means. A rating of 3 means I know the word and can recognize and understand it while reading, but probably wouldn't feel comfortable using it in writing or speech. And a rating of 4 means I know the word well, and I can use it in writing and speech. Okay, that's the scale. Now, here are the 3 vocabulary words. Rate your knowledge of each as a 1, 2, 3, or 4. The first word is ambitious. Rate your knowledge of ambitious. The second word is factotum. Rate your knowledge of factotum. The third word is Procrustean. Rate your knowledge of Procrustean. What was your rating for each word? Now, I've used this activity a number of times, and most people rate ambitious as a 4. They feel they can use this word comfortably in speech and writing. Most people rate factotum a little lower, possibly a 2 or a 3. They've heard the word factotum before, but beyond a general sense of it referring to a person, wouldn't feel comfortable using it in speech. However, these people could probably figure out the word's meaning in supportive context. And most people rate Procrustean as a 1. They've never heard the word before. Now, before we dig into the meanings of these words, let's discuss what this activity shows us. Like a dimmer switch gradually growing brighter, our knowledge of words is not an all or nothing affair. Or to use a different metaphor, some words, those we rate as four, are like our good friends. We feel comfortable with them. We've known them a long time. Some words, the ones we rate as twos or threes, are acquaintances. We know them, but not really well. And some words, the ones, are complete strangers. So as you learn new words throughout this course, remember the dimmer switch metaphor. Don't feel that you have to master them immediately, like an on-off switch. It may take some time and practice before you feel that you're comfortable with a new word, just as it may take a while for a complete stranger to become a close friend. In fact, we know from vocabulary research that it takes multiple exposures across many different contexts before we really start to know a word. For example, one study found that school-age students needed 12 encounters with a word to make a difference in their comprehension of a passage containing that word. So, now that we appreciate the dimmer switch phenomenon, what are those five principles I mentioned a moment ago? The principles of effective vocabulary learning. Well, why don't we use one of the words that we just encountered to introduce these principles in a very practical way? Let's explore the word factotum as an example of best practices in vocabulary learning. Best practices that we'll use throughout this course. So first, let's start with a clear definition. A factotum is someone hired to do a variety of jobs. Someone who has many different responsibilities. A jack of all trades. Second, place the word factotum in context. How might factotum sound in a sentence? Tessa, the office factotum, does the billing, answers the phones, fills in the PR department, and even knows how to bake a mean blueberry scone. She's indispensable. Okay, third, make connections to the word. What are some examples of a factotum? A factotum might be a general handyman around the house, someone that you hire to do a variety of odd jobs, from plumbing to fixing a window to painting a room. Now, when I think of factotum, I think of Alfred the Butler. If you've ever seen the Batman movies or read the comic books, you know Alfred. Alfred does it all. He's more than Bruce Wayne's butler. He's also the expert mechanic for the Batmobile, Batplane, and Batcopter. He keeps Batman's personal affairs in order as a sort of secretary, and he even offers Batman sage advice from time to time. His counselor. Wouldn't we all love to have an Alfred in our lives? Do you know someone like this? How about moms? Moms are factotums, aren't they? And have you ever met or worked with someone who is a jack of all trades like this? Now here's what I want you to do. Picture the word factotum next to this person's face. Make a personal connection with that vocabulary word. So, you've defined the word, you've used it in a sentence, and even made a personal connection. But how can you remember this word so you don't forget it 3 weeks from now? Now, I remember the first time I read the word factotum in a book during college. The context was not rich enough to help me figure out the meaning. So feeling motivated that day, I looked it up in a dictionary. But then I didn't see factotum again for many years, not until after college. And at that point, I couldn't remember what the word meant. I was frustrated because I knew I'd spent time looking the word up years before, but it hadn't stuck in my long-term memory. Sound familiar? However, in between my two factotum encounters, I learned one of the secrets to vocabulary acquisition, which brings me to our fourth principle of vocabulary learning. You see, I've been taking graduate literacy education courses at the University of Virginia and learned that a little knowledge of morphology, our language's system of meaning, can help us better remember a word's meaning and make it our own. So this time, I took the time to look deeper into the word and found out that the root, F-A-C, which begins factotum, is from the Latin verb facio, meaning to make or do. So what other English words do you know that start with F-A-C, How about factory? Factories make things, and people in factories do things. They're busy places. Factory became my key word for the root FAC. The meaning of the key word, factory, helped me remember the meaning of the root, FAC. So whenever I see the Latin root FAC in a word, I think of my key word factory and suspect that the word might have something to do with making or doing. Now the Latin word totum, the second part of factotum, means all and is the source for the English word total. So a factotum is someone who does everything. Factotums literally do it all. And if you remember factotum this way, you'll never forget it again. 3 weeks, 3 months, or even 3 years from now. So, do you feel like you know factotum pretty well now? What did we do to make this word so memorable? We followed four principles of vocabulary learning that we'll be using throughout this course. Definitions, context, connections, and morphology. First, for each target word, I'll provide you with a clear definition that distills the critical aspects of what a word means, and just as importantly, what it does not mean. Second, I'll place each target word in the context of a sentence, so you can actually get a feel for how it's actually used. Now remember, words were born and live in context, not in vocabulary books or lists. If you really want to study a shark, you study it in the ocean, its natural habitat. If you want to really know a word, you study how it behaves in its natural habitat. Sentences, paragraphs, and books. Now third, I'll make connections to the word and ask you to do the same. In the example that I cited before, I connected the word factotum to Alfred, Batman's butler. Think of vocabulary word as a label for an underlying concept. You already knew the basic concept of factotum. I mean, we all know someone who does a little bit of everything, but you may not have had the label, the word factotum. We connected the new word or label to your known concept. Now, in my 2 decades in education, this is one of the most powerful learning principles that I know, connecting the new to the known. So throughout this course, I'll be making new to known connections, and more importantly, asking you to make personal connections to the words we're learning. You'll connect our target words to people you know, experiences you've had, and things you've read, so you can make the words your own. And because you'll be actively making the connections, you'll be the one in charge of your own learning. The more connections you make, the more actively engaged you are, the more likely you are to make the word your own. Now, our fourth principle of vocabulary learning is to explore a word's morphology. Morphology is the study of the structure of words, including meaningful word parts like prefixes, suffixes, and roots, and patterns and processes of word formation. Our morphological system in English can be an incredibly powerful system for learning vocabulary, if you know how to tap into it. Now, to remember the word factotum, we broke it down by the meaningful parts of the word, the Latin root FAC, and the second part, totum. We call meaning parts like these, such as Latin and Greek roots, morphemes. Exploring a word's morphological structure, or as I like to say, taking the root back to the root, is a powerful and greatly underutilized vocabulary learning tool. Okay, that's 4 of our 5 vocabulary learning principles. Definition, context, connections, and morphology. Before we move to the 5th principle, how about that word Procrustean? Let's start with the definition. Procrustean means tending to produce conformity by arbitrary, ruthless, or violent means. Let's put Procrustean in context. Even though the student's poem unanimously won the all-county writing contest, the Procrustean English teacher gave her an F for failing to dot the I in her name. Ouch! That's a pretty ruthless way of enforcing conformity. Now, let's make a personal connection. Have you ever met someone who's completely inflexible? Someone who tries to make things fit, even if they don't? You know the type. They love Robert's Rules of Order. They probably carry it around in their back pockets. They're sticklers for procedures, rules, and regulations. A boss, a coworker, maybe a family member who, once you've made a plan for the day, refuses to make even a small change, then you know someone who's Procrustean. Make a personal connection. And please try to follow procedures and not make any sudden changes of plan around this Procrustean person. Now, Procrustean comes from Greek mythology. Procrustes was a mythical bandit of Attica who would waylay hapless travelers and attempt to fit them to his iron bed. If you were too long for the bed, he'd cut your feet off. And if you were too short for the bed, he'd stretch you out. Delightful gentleman, huh? Procrustes is not the kind of guy you'd like to have over for dinner to meet mom. And a Procrustean bed has come to mean an arbitrary standard to which something is forced to conform. Now, I just told you an etymological narrative about Procrustean. The etymology of a word is its history, including its origin, its evolution, and its spread to other languages, and its shift in meaning and form over time. And a narrative is a story. So, an etymological narrative is a story about the history of a word. And I like to tell word stories, not just because they're incredibly interesting, but because they help us remember words. As cognitive psychologist Daniel T. Willingham notes, our minds are hardwired to remember stories. This is why we generally find it easier to remember stories that people tell us than information presented in a non-story format, like facts in a science textbook. When we learn etymological narratives, or stories about the history of words, we leverage one of the most powerful vocabulary learning tools that we know. And a big part of a word's etymology, or history, is its morphology, including the Latin or Greek roots from which it sprang. So, we'll be exploring the word's etymology and morphology, its history and its structure, together throughout this course. So, we already have four important principles or tools in our learning toolbox. But, once we've used these principles to learn dozens or even hundreds of new words, what do we do with all these words? How do we organize them in a way that actually makes sense? How do we store these words in our mental lexicon, in our mental library of word meanings, so that when we need to retrieve them and actually use them, we know where to find them? This brings me to our fifth vocabulary learning principle. Word learning should be structured. And indeed, the best structure for learning new words is one that reflects the way that our brain naturally organizes and stores information. So to illustrate this, let's conduct a little memory experiment. I'm going to read a list of 12 words aloud. When I'm done, I'm going to ask you to repeat them. If you're able, pause the lecture at that point and try to repeat or write down as many of the words as you can remember. Don't write anything down just now, just listen and try to remember. Okay, are you ready? Here we go. Enchilada. Soccer. Louis Armstrong. Football. Burrito. Dizzy Gillespie. Hockey. Glenn Miller. Taco. Lacrosse. Oscar Peterson. Fajita. Okay, now press pause and repeat or write as many words as you can. How many words could you remember? How many were you absolutely sure of? How many did you say, but were uncertain if they were even on the list? Okay, now we're going to try this experiment one more time with one small exception. I'm going to read the same list of items aloud. However, I'm going to read them in a different order. And at the end, press pause if you can, and try to repeat or write down as many of the words as you can remember. Okay, ready? Here we go. Mexican foods, enchilada, burrito, taco, fajita. Sports, soccer, football, hockey, lacrosse. Jazz greats, Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, Glenn Miller, Oscar Peterson. Now, hit pause and recite or write down as many as you can. So how did it go? How many words could you remember this time? Now, I've done this memory experiment many times with many different audiences and nearly always come up with the same results. During the first test, when I read the words aloud randomly, most people experience difficulty remembering all the words and even become a little overwhelmed. In fact, even the people with the best memories usually can only remember about 7 words the first time. And this is consistent with memory research that shows that we only have a limited amount of working memory in which we can store information in the short term. Colleagues I've worked with call this difficulty remembering randomly presented information the mental junk drawer phenomenon. Do you have a junk drawer at home? What's in it? Little pencil nubs with no erasers? Pens with no ink? Keys that you don't even know what they open? Menus for defunct restaurants? I mean, why do we put things in the junk drawer? Well, either we're too lazy to put them away where they belong, or we don't have a place to store them. Isn't it hard to find something in that junk drawer when you need it? It's all jumbled up. It's the same way with words. When we just try and cram vocabulary words into our mental junk drawer, without any organizational scheme, we'll have a hard time finding them when we actually need them. And that's why most people find it a lot easier to remember words in this memory experiment the second time around. It's not just because they had a second time to practice them. It's because the words were organized or chunked into 3 meaningful categories. When we chunk items of information by meaningful categories, we're better able to remember them. In a sense, we don't have to remember 12 items anymore. We only have to remember 3 categories, a much easier load on the memory. This idea of chunking vocabulary items is our 5th core learning principle. And it's related to a well-known concept in education and cognitive science, schema theory. Now, according to schema theory, we organize and categorize knowledge by abstract mental frameworks or structures called schema. Think of schema as mental file folders in which we organize information. This is how we can keep track of so much information in our brains and avoid the pitfalls of the mental junk drawer. So if you say the word baseball, my schema would include my favorite team, the Philadelphia Phillies, the smell of a leather baseball glove, the taste of Cracker Jack, and some of my all-time favorite players such as Roberto Clemente and Cal Ripken Jr. Now, compare the chunking technique that we just learned about with a traditional approach to vocabulary instruction that many of us experienced in our schooling. Now, while I was incredibly fortunate to have many absolutely outstanding teachers throughout my life, I don't have overly fond memories of the way that I was taught vocabulary in high school. See if my experiences sound familiar to you. Each Monday, our class was given 30 to 40 new vocabulary words to study, all organized alphabetically. Words like baleful, ballyhoo, bastion, and bedlam. Wonderful words, but all in the same list simply because they all happen to fall under the same letter in the dictionary. B, we would memorize the words for the Friday test and forget half of them by the following Monday. Why? Because we were trying to memorize these words by rote, stuffing them into our mental junk drawer, not making connections among them, and certainly not organizing them by the way our minds worked. The words were not organized by schema or chunked by common meaning. So, how should we organize vocabulary words? Well, let's take the word kerfuffle, which means a commotion, disorder, controversy, or fuss. Wouldn't it make sense to examine kerfuffle alongside related words like imbroglio, melee, hullabaloo, tussle, Donnybrook, and spat? If this was our list for the week, we'd not only study the common meaning they all shared, a type of disagreement or fight, but just as importantly, we would examine the finer shades of distinction and nuances of meaning among these words, exploring which words implied a more violent, serious confrontation, like a Donnybrook or a melee, and which referred to a gentler disturbance, like a tussle or spat. If we organize a vocabulary learning by meaning, honoring the way our brain works will dramatically improve our chances of remembering and using these words. Now, we refer to organizing words by meaning like this as semantic chunking. In this way, when we go to retrieve the word that we want, we'll know where we stored it in the first place, instead of going on a wild goose chase for the word in our mental junk drawer. So there you have it, the 5 core principles of effective vocabulary learning: definition, context, connections, morphology, and semantic chunking. Together, these principles give us a solid foundation for building a better vocabulary. Now, I'd like to conclude today with one of my favorite etymological narratives. It's the history behind the word decimate. Now, we know that decimate means to utterly destroy something, but where did decimate come from? If we do a little morphological analysis, we find the root dec from the Latin word decem at the beginning of this word. What other words do we know that share the same root? Decade, decimal, and decathlon all share the core meaning of 10. So what does the number 10 have to do with decimating or utterly destroying something? Well, during the time of ancient Rome, while the Roman legions were out conquering much of the known world, mutiny was a big concern for the military command. Soldiers who had been away from home for years, living, fighting, and dying under incredibly harsh conditions, might start talking about rebellion. And if a Roman general got wind of a mutiny, he would select 1/10 of the mutinous soldiers by lot to be killed. So, the original meaning of the word decimate was literally to kill 1/10. Over time, as so often happens, the meaning of this word shifted and changed to the more general meaning of utterly destroying something. Pretty interesting, huh? And that's the point. When we dig into the history of words like decimate, we discover that learning vocabulary doesn't have to be the dry, deadly set of exercises that many of us experienced in school. It can be stimulating as well as enlightening. Words can change how you see the world. In Shakespeare's classic tragedy, Romeo and Juliet, Juliet asks, "What's in a name?" As a lifelong learner of vocabulary, I'm constantly asking myself a related question: what's in a word? I believe that with a little curiosity and knowledge about how words work, the answer is almost always a lot.
Lecture 2, The Spelling Meaning Connection.
In our first lecture, we discussed 5 core principles of effective vocabulary learning, starting with clear definitions, putting words in rich context, making connections between known concepts and new words, exploring the morphology and etymology of the word, and chunking words by meaning so we have an organized mental lexicon that enables us to find the word we want when we want it. Today, we'll delve a bit deeper into English's morphological system, exploring one of the big secrets of vocabulary learning. While our focus will be on how words work, we'll also be learning some marvelous words along the way. Now, in Lecture 1, we discussed how our minds organize information, including words, by schema or mental file folders. Traditional one-word-at-a-time vocabulary instruction, the approach many of us experienced in high school, leads to cramming tons of words haphazardly into our mental junk drawers because we don't have mental file folders to store our vocabulary. When we cram words, we may remember them for the Friday quiz, but we'd be hard-pressed to find and use the vocabulary when we really need them, weeks, months, or years from now. Sound familiar to you? Did you ever cram for a test or exam in high school or college? Did you remember the information years later? We can avoid the pitfalls of this mental junk drawer trap by organizing our vocabulary learning by meaning and general concept. For example, by creating a mental file folder where we can put words associated with good and evil, another mental file folder where we can store words about liars, cheats, and swindlers, and so on. This is why I've organized the course by concept, rather than just organizing words like ballyhoo and bedlam, because they happen to start with the letter B. When we organize words this way, by meaning, we capitalize on how our minds tend to organize information. So, we now know how our minds organize language, but how does our language organize words? Does the English language have a secret system, a code we've not been privy to? To get at these big questions, let's start with a couple of smaller, more focused questions that I'm commonly asked. First, how many words are there in the English language? And second, of this total corpus of words in the English language, how many does the average high school or college graduate know? So looking at that first question, what do you think? How many words are there in the English language? Do you think there are 6,000 words? 60,000 words? 600,000 words? Or 6 million words? Like it or not, there's no easy answer to this, and much of it depends on what your definition of a word is and what types of words you decide to include. For example, should respect, respected, respectful, and respectfully be counted as 4 words or 1 word? For the purposes of this lecture, I'm going to go with the number of definitions included in what most consider the authoritative dictionary in the English language, the Oxford English Dictionary. The OED second edition includes over 600,000 definitions. Now, most of us know only a portion of these words. And by know, I mean we understand the meanings of these words if we encountered them in a book, newspaper, or magazine. Understanding words. This is your receptive vocabulary. And most of us feel comfortable using an even smaller portion in speech or writing. This is your expressive vocabulary. So by this definition, what do you think the average receptive vocabulary of a high school graduate is? A college graduate. A classic study by researchers William E. Nagy and Richard C. Anderson estimates that the average high school student knows between 25 and 50,000 words. And language expert David Crystal estimates that the average college graduate knows approximately 75,000 words. Now, compared to 600,000 total words, a 75,000 word vocabulary may seem small, but actually it's a pretty impressive number. And if you think about it, there's no way you can obtain a 75,000 word vocabulary through direct instruction one word at a time. We don't learn words one at a time like beads on a string. This is why traditional word-by-word approaches to learning vocabulary aren't the most effective. So, how do people build great vocabularies? Well, first and foremost, we acquire a deep, broad, and flexible vocabulary through wide reading. Think about the people you know who possess excellent vocabularies. They're probably also the most avid readers you know. As adults, we pick up the significant majority of new vocabulary incidentally through meaningful reading in connected text, and environmentally from listening, discussing, and using words in meaningful contexts. Does this mean that we should just give up on studying vocabulary directly, hoping to improve through reading alone? Absolutely not. But it does mean that if we're serious about improving our vocabulary, in addition to wide reading, we need to be strategic and thoughtful about how we study vocabulary, making the best use of our limited time to receive the biggest payoff in learning. And this is where the 5 principles we discussed last time come in. They help us get the biggest bang for our buck when we study vocabulary. And I'm going to facilitate your learning by organizing the words in this course by general concept and meaning. In other words, I'm going to employ the schema approach we've already discussed. But in addition to this, wouldn't it be wonderful if our language already organize words that same way? By meaning? If this was the case, our minds and our language could work hand in hand. Now, at first glance, this doesn't appear to be the case. Most of the tools we use to learn about words are organized alphabetically. Think of dictionaries and encyclopedias, right? However, I'm going to argue that our language, and in particular the vocabulary of our language, is organized by meaning, if you know how to look for it. There's a secret to learning vocabulary, a method that can be much more effective than the traditional word-by-word approach to vocabulary instruction that many of us experienced in school. Actually, I've already alluded to this secret in Lecture 1, so let me state it very plainly right now. English has a built-in system of meaning, or morphology, that is largely based on the classic Greek and Latin origins of our language. Those who know how to harness this morphological system are at a great advantage not only when it comes to learning more words, but also when it comes to storing them more solidly in your mental lexicon. And the good news is that you don't have to be a Latin or Greek scholar to capitalize on this morphological system. In fact, one of the reasons this system is so powerful is that it builds on words that you already know, as I'll show you shortly. So just how powerful is this system of morphology? Is it worth spending our time examining Latin and Greek roots in this course? Specifically, what percentage of English vocabulary is based on Latin or Greek prefixes, suffixes, or roots? What do you think? 20%? 40%? Do I hear 50%? Higher? What do you think? The eye-opening answer is that approximately 70% of English vocabulary is derived from Latin or Greek affixes or roots. 70%! Now, do you think the vocabulary of science and technology is higher or lower than this 70%? If you said higher, you're right. Over 90% of our scientific vocabulary is created by a combination of Greek and Latin morphemes. Think of medical terms like arthritis, bronchitis, conjunctivitis, all of which include the Greek suffix itis. And think of other fields like law and the multitude of associated legal terms, such as habeas corpus and amicus curiae. Think of how many vocabulary terms, concepts, and expressions and disciplines and fields like these come from Greek and Latin. So, if 70% of our language and approximately 90% of our scientific language is based on a particular system of morphology, doesn't it make sense to learn about this system? Put another way, what makes more sense, studying 75,000 separate words, one word at a time, or learning the system that underlies the vast majority of these words? One of the keys to unlocking this morphological system is a concept known as the spelling-meaning connection, a term coined and examined by vocabulary researcher Shane Templeton. Now, as we discuss the spelling-meaning connection, you're going to see that our spelling system, also known as orthography, makes a lot more sense than you may have originally thought. Now, to show you how this works, let me invite you to spell the word health. My health is good. Health. How is it spelled? H-E-A-L-T-H. Have you ever wondered why the word health is spelled with a silent A? Why don't we just spell it as it sounds phonetically as H-E-L-T-H? In fact, that silent A is there for a very good reason. If you take the T-H off the end of health, what word are you left with? That's right, heal. You can see now why it makes sense to keep the spelling of health with an A, to visually clue us into the fact that health is directly related to, in the meaning, to heal, healer, healthy, unhealthy, and the list goes on. Thus, the spelling-meaning connection states, words that are related in spelling are often related in meaning, despite changes in sound. That's the spelling-meaning connection. And there are many other word pairs that illustrate the spelling-meaning connection in English. They show you why it makes sense to keep the silent letters in many of our spellings. Here are some examples of silent-sounding consonant pairs in English. And by the way, these are fun questions to ask a neighbor you want to impress at your next get-together. Have you ever wondered about that silent N in the word column? A column is written by who? A columnist. How about the silent N in hymn? Where can you find a hymn? In a hymnal. And what about the silent B in crumb? You get a crumb when you crumble a cookie. These silent letters are a direct visual clue that these words are related in meaning and came from the same root word. If we decided to delete these silent letters and only spell words by sound, we would lose this important spelling-meaning connection that's built into English's DNA. Now, how about the word resign? I want to resign from my job. Resign. R-E-S-I-G-N. What related word is the silent G sounded in? Well, when you resign, you must turn in your resignation. And let's think of 10 other words that are related in spelling and meaning to resign. Resignation, resign, sign, insignia, design, designation, signal, significant, insignificant, signature, and signatory. Wow. In fact, all these words are derived from the Latin root signum, which means a symbol or mark. They all share a common core meaning related to a common spelling. You can see how powerful this system can be. Those of us who take this morphological approach to teaching words, we like to say, when you learn one word, you actually learn 10. This is because one single root like signum can be the key to unlocking the meanings of many other words that are derived from that root. Your knowledge of just a relatively small number of roots can exponentially increase your vocabulary. In terms of morphological knowledge, a little goes a long way. So you can begin to see why Noam Chomsky, one of the great linguists of our time, proposed that English spelling, or what linguists term orthography, is a near optimal system for representing words. Many critics of our spelling system don't get this. Our spelling system didn't evolve simply to represent sound. Spelling evolved to also represent meaning. This is why word nerds like me love our spelling system the way it is. So don't change it. Knowing a little bit about spelling can actually improve your vocabulary knowledge. So in essence, what we're seeing is that language organizes words by morphology. And if we appreciate that fact, we can use morphology as a powerful tool to improve our vocabulary. To illustrate this further, let's return to a word we explored in Lecture 1, factotum. Do you remember what a factotum is? How do we break the word down in order to understand its meaning? If you remember, we analyzed factotum into two morphemes, FAC and totum. FAC is from the Latin word facio, which means to do or make. You may remember this because I connected it to a key word, factory, with the Latin root FAC. A factory is a place that makes things. And by the way, for every target root in this course, I'll be providing you with a keyword to unlock its meaning. Keywords are important. You'll also recall that the Latin word totum means all. So a factotum is someone who does everything, a jack of all trades. Now you may be thinking, that's great, Kevin, but how can that help me learn other words? This is where the power of the spelling-meaning connection comes into play. How many other English words contain this root, FAC, besides factotum? Let me give you a few. First, we'll analyze some FAC words you already know well, then we'll move on to some less familiar ones. A fact. A fact is something that's true. Now, how is that related to making or doing, the core meaning of the FAC root? Well, fact is derived from the Latin factum, meaning thing done. If something was done, it actually happened, and therefore, it's true. It's a fact. Manufacture. The M-A-N-U in manufacture is the Latin word for hand, as in the phrase manual labor. So something that is manufactured is literally made by hand, not something found in nature. You can see how fact and manufacture share the same core meaning of do or make. Here are a few more FAC words to give you a sense of how productive this root is. Factor, facsimile, benefactor, artifact, and facilitate. All these words derive from one single root. And I could go on. That's a pretty productive root. And now let's look at one FAC word you may not be as familiar with. Factitious. What do you think factitious means? Do you think factitious means A, without any facts or substantial evidence to back up a false claim or argument? Or B, artificial rather than natural, not genuine, a sham, contrived? Before I tell you the definition, let me tell you my factitious story. I love to laugh and tell jokes. I love to laugh at other people's jokes. But if someone else's joke or story is not funny, if it falls flat, I still feel obliged to laugh. I don't want to make that person feel bad. I guess I'm just kind of a pushover and a softy in that way. However, my own children tell me they can see right through me. They say I've got two laughs, my real laugh and my fake laugh. I've got a real, genuine, witch-like cackle when I really think something spit out your coffee hilarious, and a factitious laugh when I want to laugh at someone's bad joke to make them feel better, a pity laugh. They can tell my factitious pity laugh because I smile slightly, nod my head, and sort of chuckle. Not only can my kids see right through my factitious laugh, but my daughter Grace loves to mimic it. So, after having heard this story, do you think factitious means A, without any facts to back up a false claim, or B, artificial rather than natural, not genuine? If you said B, you were right. Now let's apply four of the five principles we learned about last time, starting with a definition. Factitious, an adjective, has two related definitions. It means one, made or manufactured, not natural. So, a flower made out of plastic would be a factitious flower. Or two, made up in the sense of contrived, a sham, fake, or phony, like my fake laugh. Okay, now that we have a definition, let's put factitious in context. The CIA agent hid his message inside the hollow, factitious rock by the bridge. His handler would pick up the message a few hours later. My dad's factitious smile didn't fool anyone. He was definitely not happy to see our cousins, who showed up, once again, unannounced. Now let's make a connection. Connect the word factitious to something in your own personal experience that is artificial, not natural, not genuine, a sham. Perhaps you own a fake diamond. You have a factitious diamond. Or perhaps you're put in a situation where you felt obliged to put on a factitious smile or laugh. Now, factitious can be a little tricky to remember because it has the word fact in it, and you might think it means true. But remember, exploring the etymology and the morphology of a word, its history and its structure, is often our best tool for making those word meanings stick. So, let's take the root back to the root to help us remember factitious. Now, as we just discussed, the root in factitious is the Latin root FAC, meaning make. Remember that our key word for FAC is a factory. What does a factory do? It makes things. And here's the important part for this word. Things that are made by humans are not natural. So when you think of factitious, think of factories making artificial things. Things that are not natural. Also think of my fake factitious laugh. Okay, we have a usage alert. Usage alert. Throughout these lectures, I'll be giving you usage alerts when I want to make a point about a commonly misused or misunderstood word, or about two words that are confused. Factitious is sometimes confused with facetious. But facetious means not serious, as in something intended to be humorous or amusing, such as a frivolous remark or person. Now, I hope this discussion has demonstrated the power of a morphological approach to vocabulary learning. How one single root, like FAC, can be the key to unlocking and generating the meanings of scores of derived words. As I said before, with morphological knowledge, a little goes a long way. Now, these two lectures have focused on learning how to learn vocabulary. Well, we've explored some wonderful word meanings, such as Procrustean, factotum, and factitious. We've primarily focused on important vocabulary learning principles and concepts as the tools in our vocabulary strategies toolbox that we'll use for the rest of this course. From here on out, we're going to pick up the pace in terms of learning specific words. We're going to cover approximately 8 to 10 target words per lecture, with a lot of bonus words thrown in that I'll mention, but not discuss as deeply as the target words. To keep this cornucopia of vocabulary organized, I strongly advise you to create a vocabulary notebook or a vocabulary file on your computer or tablet. Organize this notebook along the same lines as our lectures, by general concept and topic. So, you might have a section for words having to do with pride and humility, in which you'd include words like bumptious, supercilious, and fawning. You also might want to add a separate section on affixes and roots. Or, you might want to include the affixes and roots with the topics as we discuss them. Do whatever works best for you. For each word in your notebook, use our vocabulary learning principles. Include a clear definition and write the word in a rich contextual sentence so you know what it means. Make a personal connection to the word. If the word describes a person you know or relates to an experience you've had, write that person's name down as an example or jot down the experience. Draw a picture of the word if that helps. Pictures can be incredibly powerful memory tools. Don't worry if you're not artistic. I'm not. Stick figures and rudimentary sketches will do. As long as you can tell what the image is, it will help you remember the word. Also, as you enter words into your notebook, include notes on the morphology and etymology of the words as I discuss them in the lectures. Remember, your knowledge of the roots from which the words are derived can be your shortcut back to the word meaning. A root can serve as your hook to help you remember a word for the long haul, 10 days, 10 months, and even 10 years from now. You can organize your vocabulary notebook into the traditional Cornell 2-column note system. Make the left column narrow and the right column wide. Write the target vocabulary word in the narrow left column. You want a wide right column because this is where you write all the information you want about that word. Definitions, personal connections, pictures, morphology, whatever helps you own that word. With a vocabulary notebook, don't worry about perfection. The process is just as important as the product. Because you're actively engaged in working with the words, you'll learn them. So during the lectures, I'll be making reference to the vocabulary notebook, giving you tips and ideas of what you might want to include for various words. Also, as you continue to learn and collect words on your own after you finish this course, you can include them in the notebook and add new topical sections. Think of this vocabulary notebook as your own repository of powerful words that you can draw on when you need. Now, to wrap up our introduction to learning principles and concepts, I'd like to end this lecture with Morphology 101. Don't worry, you don't have to have a PhD in linguistics to learn vocabulary effectively. But it will be helpful to know some important morphological terms that I'll be using throughout this course. Base words, roots, prefixes, suffixes, and affixes. These terms will be our vocabulary for learning vocabulary. Let's start with a simple word, unprofitable. Now, a base word is a word that can stand on its own. In the word unprofitable, the base word is profit. It can stand alone, and when it does so, profit just means monetary gain. A prefix is a morpheme or unit of meaning that can be attached to the beginning of a base word or root. The prefix in unprofitable is un, meaning not. A suffix is a morpheme or unit of meaning that can be attached to the end of a base word or root. The suffix in unprofitable is able, meaning capable of. So, if you put the prefix un, the base word prophet, and the suffix able together, you get unprofitable, which means not capable of making a monetary gain. Now, affix is the umbrella term for prefixes and suffixes. So, when you hear me say affix in this course, you'll know I'm talking about prefixes and suffixes collectively. What about roots? Well, roots are morphemes that cannot stand alone, but to which prefixes and suffixes can attach. We've already worked extensively with one root, FAC. And another example is the Latin root, SPECT, meaning look or see. Spect isn't a standalone English word, but it's an incredibly fertile root. Now, you may have heard the term root word before, but I don't like this term. We'll use the term roots and not root words in this course because, as one of my students asked me, why are we calling these root words if they're not really words that can stand alone? Now, my key word for the root spect is spectacles. What do spectacles do? They help you see or look at things. And what's the job of an inspector? She looks into things. What does a spectator do? He looks at things. Listen to these other words derived from spect, all having to do with looking. Speculate, to look ahead. Retrospect, to look back. And introspect, to look in. Looking at roots in this way can be a lot of fun. I remember exploring the spect root with a group of middle school students. Now, we live about 30 miles outside of Philadelphia, and one of the students had gone to the Spectrum, the stadium where the Philadelphia 76ers used to play basketball. When she realized that the word spectrum contained the root spect, she became ecstatic, shouting, "Oh my God, I was a spectator at the Spectrum! I was a spectator at the Spectrum!" To which a quick-witted boy in the group replied, "Were you wearing your spectacles?" Let's finish today with a less familiar spect word, circumspect. So what do you think circumspect means? Well, circumspect means cautious, prudent, and it's another word, like factotum, that I had to look up multiple times in college until I got smart and looked up the words morphology, and I've remembered it ever since. We know that spect means look, but what does circum mean? Well, what other words do you know that contain circum? How about circumference and circumnavigate? Circum means around. So the two roots in circumspect mean look around. But how does look around relate to the meaning of circumspect, cautious and prudent? Well, you tell me. What does a cautious, wary person do before she acts? She looks around to make sure everything's copacetic. So, when you think of circumspect, think of a cautious person looking around, cautious of her surroundings. What a great visual to help us remember this word, a visual that we get from a little morphological knowledge. As I noted earlier, we spent these first two lectures laying a solid methodological foundation. That is, we focused on how to learn vocabulary effectively. Now, it's time to start building our vocabulary in earnest. I'll see you next time.
Lecture 3. Words for lying, swindling, and conniving.
Last year, I attended a conference in New Orleans. And after the conference one evening, I was in the French Quarter walking down Bourbon Street on the way to dinner with some colleagues. Just then, a man seemed to pop up out of the crowd right in front of me. He pulled out a $5 bill and he said, "I bet you $5 I can tell you where you got your shoes and even what street you got your shoes on." Well, luckily for me, someone had tried this exact same con on me over 20 years before, the last time I was in New Orleans. I'd waited 20 years for this exact moment. So I said to him, I said, "How about I tell you, I got my shoes on my feet, and I got my feet on Bourbon Street. Now, can I have that five?" Smiling and shaking his head, he said, "Aw, man." And he pocketed the five, and he melted back into the crowd. Unfortunately, just like me in New Orleans, we've all encountered someone who's tried to con, lie, deceive, hoodwink, bamboozle, dupe, scam, bilk, or fleece us at one time or another in our lives. But fortunately, English has some wonderful words to describe liars and the lies they tell. So in this lecture, I'll introduce you to 9 powerful words to describe the cheats, swindlers, charlatans, scam artists, barracudas, sharks and sharpies, and all their swindles, hustles, flimflams, and double dealings. So let's start by discussing 2 types of tricksters we've all encountered in our lives: mountebanks and sophists. Okay, imagine this. You can't sleep, so you're up late watching TV again, channel surfing while munching a bag of potato chips. And you come upon an infomercial on channel 723. Now the salesman seems a bit too slick for you. He claims he's a doctor, and he's giving you the hard sell on an extract from a root of a plant that you've never even heard of. He says the plant is only found in some remote location in the Amazon River Basin. And he claims that it will cure everything from migraines to stomach aches to low testosterone levels. Needless to say, you're skeptical of the self-proclaimed expert's extravagant claims. Well, there is a wonderful word for this type of fast-talking con man who sells quack remedies: a mountebank. Mountebank is a flamboyant swindler, a flimflammer, someone who claims to be an expert, but really isn't. Mountebanks often claim to be doctors, but they can just as easily claim to be any other type of expert. However, don't be fooled. Underneath their authentic appearances, they're frauds and imposters. Okay, here's the word mountebank used in context. Our town was completely duped by the slick-talking imposter who breezed into town, claimed to be a physician, and sold us his quack remedies. We didn't realize he was a mountebank of the first order until after he left and we found his cure-alls were complete shams. Now, as with so many words, the etymology of the word mountebank can help us remember its meaning. Mountebank comes from an Italian phrase meaning to mount a bench and refers to a quack doctor or swindler who would enter a town, mount a bench in the public square so the crowd could better see and hear him, get it, and try to sell his fake potions to a susceptible public. So, to remember mountebank, picture a fake doctor standing or mounted on a bench trying to hawk his counterfeit elixirs. And I want you to highlight the mount in mountebank in your vocabulary notebook. If you remember mount as your key word in mountebank, you won't forget its meaning. Now, you might even want to draw a quick sketch of a doctor on a bench in your vocabulary notebook next to the word mountebank. Just a stick figure with the label doctor will do. What matters is that the image triggers the word's meaning for you. Okay, so let's make a personal connection. Take a moment and think of a mountebank you have encountered in your own life. Someone who's made extravagant claims trying to sell you something that didn't quite live up to the billing. Write down this personal experience next to the word mountebank in your notebook. Remember, making personal connections to word meanings will help you to store these words in your lexicon, your mental library of words, so you can use them later in conversation and writing. Now, synonyms for mountebank include charlatan, con artist, one I like, flimflammer, conniver, and shyster. Now, our second word refers to a different type of trickster. Not one trying to sell you a counterfeit product, like a mountebank, but someone trying to sell you a counterfeit argument. Now, I want you to think back to a time you've watched a political debate, okay? The first politician begins to construct her argument, and it's compelling, and starting to sway you to that politician's side. Then the second politician begins to rebut the first politician's argument, poking holes in her reasoning, demonstrating how she played fast and loose with the facts. Now, at this point in the debate, the veil is lifted from your eyes, and you realize that this first politician was intentionally trying to deceive you with her verbal gymnastics. This first politician who intentionally tried to pull the wool over your eyes is a sophist. S-O-P-H-I-S-T. A sophist is a noun referring to one skilled in elaborate and devious argumentation. Sophists engage in clever arguments specifically designed to persuade or convince others, not caring how sound or logical the arguments are, but trying to win the arguments with the splitting of words. Okay, let's try sophist in context. The debate team failed to win when the judges saw through their clever